From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a pioneer in African democracy. We'll speak with former Nigerian President Obasanjo about the stability of his country today and a future partnership with UW-Milwaukee. Later, we'll learn about a current partnership between Milwaukee and developing nations to improve health care.
The thing about healthcare is that it knows no boundaries. So it's really important to all of our institutions, and even in the U.S., that we understand and can help with problems that occur overseas.
And an in-studio conversation with and concert by musician Vince Sherman.
So come in close to me. As close as two can be. Unless you order.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. Nigeria has had a troubled relationship with democracy since it gained independence in 1960. After years of military rule, civilian government was restored in 1999 under the presidency of Olusegun Obasanjo. Obasanjo led the country till 2007, when, for the first time since independence, power was transferred by election from one civilian regime to the next. Still, the country of nearly 175 million people continues to struggle with corruption and graft in public institutions, ethnic and religious tensions, and shortcomings in education and health care. Nigeria is also one of the youngest countries in the world. 43% of the population is under age 14. Former President Obasanjo now heads a foundation seeking stability and sustainability in Nigeria. He traveled to Milwaukee this week for the second time in an effort to forge a collaborative effort with UW-Milwaukee. And he joins us in the Lake Effect studio to share more. Your Excellency, Chief Obasanjo, welcome to Lake Effect. It's an honor.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be in this city and to be with UWM.
Let me ask you, how stable do you see the state of democracy in Nigeria?
Well, I would say that after three elections and we have moved from election to regime succession, I believe we are fairly stable. Of course, as is normal in a democracy, the period of election is always a period of activity, and the usual activity, particularly where you have more than two parties, there will be parties coming together and parties not coming together, and that sort of thing. It tends to give people some concern. But I believe for Nigeria, we are in for democracy to be sustained.
Well, and when we look at democracy in Africa from the United States, we inevitably compare it to our own. Is it inappropriate for us to expect democracy in Nigeria and other African states to look just like it does here?
Not really, because there are no two democracies that are exactly the same. There are certain important milestones, if you put it that way, that a democracy must have. There must be periodic election. There must be some form of organization, normally political party, to contest the election. There must be competition of some sort. But there are parliamentary democracies. There are presidential democracies. There are a hybrid of part parliamentary, part presidential. For instance, Nigeria is a presidential democracy. The U.S. is a presidential democracy. But there are qualifications that are different in our two presidential democracies. In our case, anybody who wins the election in our presidential democracy must also win certain percentage of votes cast in a number of states. Now, this is to ensure a widespread of popularity, because it's not enough to say, yes, I got the number. You must be fairly popular across the board. Here you don't have that type of a qualification, but you have another form of qualification which is different from ours, that after the popular vote, you have
the Electoral College.
The Electoral College, which is so you may win here, for instance, you may win the popular vote and not win the election. Now, that has happened. Whereas in our own case, you may win the popular vote and not have the spread. You can see. And if that happens, of course, you will have to go in again. Now, I think what really matters is that the form or shape and practice of each democracy is accepted by the people. And at the end of the day, when elections take place, it reflects the will of the people. The result or the outcome reflects the will of the people.
Recently, there was news of a letter you wrote this month to the current president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, warning that the country was in danger of stepping backwards. What was your concern in writing that letter?
Well, it's good governance, pure and simple. When this present dispensation started, we started on the basis of democracy and dividend of democracy to the people, which means good governance, which means enhancing the quality of life of all the people of Nigeria, which means certain malpractices of the past that did not allow people to actually have full dividend of democracy must be eliminated. And that's all my letter of appeal was about.
Do you believe it's too late for Mr. Jonathan to deliver on his promise of good governance? Is his administration flawed?
The title of my letter is Before It Is Too Late. And I sincerely believe that the president can still make amend before it is too late.
Let me ask you about another area that people in the West are often concerned about. How should the West view the threat of international terrorism coming out of places such as Nigeria and Mali and other African states? For example, is Boko Haram a threat beyond Africa?
Well, I went into Boko Haram a little more than 2 years ago. And what I saw then was that Boko Haram could be nipped in the bud as a national, even as a state. You know, we have 36 states. It was mainly localized in one state. Now, at that time, the lawyer of Boko Haram who acted as proxy for me to be able to reach out to them, told me that the involvement of outsiders in Boko Haram could not be more than 20%. So a stitch in time will have saved 9. About 6 months ago, I spoke to the same man who said, as of today, the foreign involvement or the external involvement is well over 50%. That is making it more difficult even for us to manage. And then, of course, it's also getting more and more externalized. There was a time when members of Boko Haram were being recruited to be trained in Mali. Now, that is a very, very disturbing development. But I still believe that with working with our neighbors, countries that surround us, and working with the region or sub-region of West Africa, and working with countries that have the wherewithal to give us intelligence and help us with intelligence and, if necessary, with materials and equipment, I believe we can still nip under. Of course, dealing with it on the basis of stick and carrot, I believe we can still put the menace of Boko Haram behind us.
So to go back to the previous question, you don't think it's too late in this case either?
Well, again, you see, in all these things, the question of leadership. Now, if the leadership acts as it should act, when it should act, how it should act, I think it may not be too late. But like a bad sore, when you delay, it festers. And when it festers, it becomes more difficult.
The demographics of Nigeria are somewhat different than the United States in one key respect. The average population is much, much younger than in the United States. What is the effect of what seems a little like the baby boom that played out in the United States 50 years ago? What is the opportunity for such a young population that you see?
I think the way it played out here could also be the way it will play out in Nigeria if we handle it correctly. You see, for me, population should not be seen as a liability. It could be a very important asset if, one, it is educated, it is given the right orientation and attitude, it acquires skill, and it goes into employment. Population could be an asset. Now, it is when population is not educated, it's poorly oriented, and not given the desired and appropriate skill, and does not have employment, then it feeds into the poverty cycle and it's dangerous.
Is there an opportunity with such a young population for it to have an impact on the issue of corruption that, that again, we in the West view Nigeria often through this lens where we're told corruption is a huge issue? Is there an opportunity with a younger population to use that to end that cycle as well?
Well, when I talk about governance, fighting corruption is an indication of good governance. And corruption and wholesomeness of the society, including eliminating restiveness of the youth, eliminating the danger of explosion that could come from the youth, is part of good governance. And I believe that if good governance will actually take sway, corruption will be grossly minimized. There's no nation in the world that is absolutely free of corruption. But there are many nations in the world where corruption is not a way of life. And what we must strive for is to make sure that corruption is not a way of life in Nigeria. That will happen once those who are caught are dealt with immediately, seriously, and we allow the punishment to be in line with the offense.
What does Nigeria gain from an alliance with a school like the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee?
Well, in every way, education that Nigeria desires, there are many components of that education that a university like the UWM can offer. And what we are saying and what we are here for is how can we work out a partnership that will be mutually beneficial, but where Nigeria will derive a benefit and where a university like UWM will also benefit. I see it as a two-way affair.
Is the hope that Nigerian students might be able to take advantage of the university here and bring back the expertise to Nigeria? Is there also hope that, people from Milwaukee will be on the ground in Nigeria as well, a little of both?
No, it's a question of we have experts here that come to Nigeria. We have we could have exchange of students. We could also have exchange of even experts because there's no body who knows it all. And if only to interact and see and make the staff of UWM know more about Africa, its culture, its challenges, its aspirations, and can then take advantage of closer relationship with Africa through African universities and UWM, I think we are building relationship. We are building partnership, and we are building the world of cooperation, collaboration, which we need.
Is there something in the legacy of Nelson Mandela to South Africa that Nigeria should look to for its future?
I think we have more or less done what Nelson Mandela did. If you are talking of legacy, we have a civil war. And at the end of our civil war, we said there was no victor, no vanquished. And that is what Nelson Mandela really stood for, forgiveness and forbearance after the apartheid policy. The only difference is that Nelson Mandela, as the main victim, the symbol of the of the what I call the atrocities or tyranny of apartheid. He became the president and he showed forgiveness and forbearance. But we did that in our civil war. At the end of it, he said, no victor, no vanquished.
Well, and so let me ask you this important question. How do you see Nigeria's chances of getting out of Group F in next year's World Cup? You're up against Argentina and Iran and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Is there optimism in Nigeria?
Of course, we believe that the taste of the pudding is in the eating. And this pudding is the one that we will eat. And we are working hard to show the world that in the area of soccer, we have come of age.
Well, Chief Obasanjo, best of luck to you. Best of luck to it's the Screaming Eagles, correct? And best of luck in your work. Thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Olusegun Obasanjo served as president of Nigeria from 1999 to 2007. Today, he's founder of a UK-based foundation that bears his name and is aimed at, quote, advancing human security in Africa. He was in Milwaukee this week to continue work on a partnership between UW-Milwaukee and education interests in Nigeria. Another Milwaukee organization has been collaborating to improve health in developing nations for 27 years. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we spoke with a former president of Nigeria who's in Wisconsin this week to forge a partnership between UW-Milwaukee and educational institutions in his country. But another international partnership has been underway here for more than a quarter century. In 1986, a group of hospitals, higher education institutions, and companies joined together with Milwaukee County to establish a healthcare partnership with global aspirations. The Center for International Health was started with the assistance of USAID, the Agency for International Development, and has trained several thousand health workers in more than 40 countries. Terry Cooley is interim president and CEO of the center, and Randall Lambrecht is chair of the center's board of directors in addition to being vice president of research and academic relations at Aurora Healthcare. They joined us in October to explain more. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Why is this center, the Center for International Health, here in Milwaukee, and why does it involve the partners that it does?
And that's really the uniqueness of the center. I mean, I think a lot of folks in maybe southeastern Wisconsin don't know that the Milwaukee Center for International Health exists. But it's a very unique consortium, a jewel, if you will, of academic institutions, health systems, and government coming together to look at how we might work on an international level around global health problems.
Well, and these various institutions have a fair amount of responsibility to people in just this region alone. And so expanding it beyond that to serving the world, does that come out of a sense of altruism?
What the center brings to the table in the same respect is the opportunity for them to use those areas of expertise in particular places throughout the world that'll have a maximum impact. One thing we've done is use a model of train the trainers. So when we train five people in a country in a particular healthcare area, they might go back and train 10 others. So we have an exponential effect of the training that we've done over the last 25 years.
Let's go back a step and talk about the specific areas. I mean, not all of them, because clearly there are a lot of them. But what are the kinds of areas of expertise that are being tapped? And what is the kind of work that emerges?
Well, one of our early I'll start with an earlier one, which was primary healthcare training, which was done in around 1988 in Malawi and Zimbabwe, where we And our consortium members conducted two-week workshops in each of those countries in primary health care. So that was one of our earlier efforts. A couple years later, we had a very major emergency medical services training program in Poland. And this was just after the collapse of communism, and they were trying to get their economy and their whole, you know, social system, you know, put back together. And one key area that they needed a lot of help in was emergency medicine. We had doctors from the Medical College of Wisconsin and Children's Hospital go over there and provide training in emergency medical services. We held a Polish-American Congress on EMS training in Warsaw in 1995 with people from other countries, from Belarus to Estonia to Latvia, also attending the Congress. So those are some of our earlier efforts.
How does Poland or how does Malawi or how does any of these countries that is leveraging the work of the center, how do they find you? Why do they find you and how does the partnership get going?
Some are found through grants. And certainly in the case of Poland, because we were still rooted in Milwaukee County government, Milwaukee County around that time had also established a sister city relationship with the city of Białystok in Poland. And so that was kind of a springboard for the Center for International Health to kind of move in that direction and provide services in that area.
The center has had a unique relationship, as Terry mentioned before, with some of the governmental agencies, the U.S. Agency for International Development for one, and the American International Health Alliance. These are agencies who initially worked with the center, were really impressed by the work of the center, and then we continue to forge those relationships. So a lot of the work comes through the center rather than having to work with multiple institutions because the attractiveness of the consortium that can bring a lot of resources together.
I wonder about analogies to other programs like say, the Peace Corps. How much of what the center does is about jump-starting work that's being done and how much is about instilling programs that can be self-sustaining in these countries?
I think we're always looking for self-sustaining, you know, approaches to the opportunities we've gone into. Sometimes that's possible. Sometimes it may not be. But I would say that's always the effort that we try to look toward. As an example, Milwaukee County has a relationship in Buffalo City, which is in South Africa. And we received a Sister Cities grant that the center had helped the county apply for, and then the center really managed the project. And that has provided an expansion of a women's health clinic in that area, an improvement of the water supply, additional rooms to see women in, and it's increased the number of women who can be seen in the clinic by 30-some percent. That's there for now and in the future. So that's an idea of a sustainable project.
There recently was a new agreement that the center entered into with a couple of institutions for the administration of the work that's being done. Why was that an important step in the evolution of the Center for International Health?
We're really excited about the new agreement. For many years, Children's Hospital served as the fiscal agent, administrative agent for the center, and they've been a terrific partner. I think after 25 years, we're now in our 27th year, I think, of existence. We've thought that it really needs to broaden out and other consortium members wanted to step up and support the center. So what makes UWM so attractive is the breadth and depth of a university that a university brings to a center like ours. I mean, they have the Institute of World Affairs and they have schools and colleges and public health and nursing and health sciences, plus the liberal arts, which I think give the center that sort of awareness and breadth and depth. The other part of that is the Medical College of Wisconsin, which has long had a really rigorous global health program, and I think it's called Nations to Neighborhoods, but it articulates and work and sits very well with the mission of the center. How do we take care of health issues outside of the country, but that can maybe be translated to urban centers or even rural areas?
Well, and that gets to another question I had, which is there something that American health practitioners and organizations and institutions take from doing this work in places where quality health care isn't necessarily something people can take for granted?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's a great educational environment for students as well as faculty and practitioners. And I think whether it's a food relief program or whether we're trying to tackle issues around HIV and AIDS in countries that have very little healthcare. What we can bring to the table in terms of training the trainer and leaving there with something better than they had is really the goal of our efforts overseas.
Well, and is there a vision for where this could be going?
Well, there's no shortage of health needs, and the thing about healthcare is that it knows no boundaries. So it's really important to all of our institutions, and even in the U.S., that we understand and can help with problems that occur overseas. So I think as we look at the next decade or maybe 20 years of the center, we really want to get in those communities where we can make a difference and then bring that knowledge back and address issues that impact our own communities here. I think that's sort of the goal of the academic institutions and the healthcare systems that are part of our center.
And I would add that while the center had its roots with local government, and local government is still providing support, for about 15 years, we've been a 501c3 nonprofit, so we've got the flexibility that brings to bring in and out different consortium members or others outside of our consortium, depending on the program that we're focusing on.
Well, it's a terrific story. Thank you to both of you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for letting us tell it.
Thank you.
Terry Cooley is the interim president and CEO of the Milwaukee-based Center for International Health. Randall Lambrecht is chair of the center's board of directors. One of the center's current programs involves training pharmacists from Zambia in work to treat pediatric HIV and AIDS. There's a link to our October interview with those pharmacists from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Just a week to go before Christmas, which has some people excited, some people worried about finishing their shopping, and others, like Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank, not especially moved.
I once worked at a social service agency filled with people who truly cared about humanity and toiled diligently for small pay to understand and help everyone. One December, I was chatting with the boss, a smart and sympathetic woman, who seemed unusually harassed. I asked her why, and she said, "Oh, you know, it's the Christmas shopping." To which I replied, "No, I don't know. I have never been Christmas shopping in my life." Taking a sip of coffee to better digest this unexpected response, she said, "Well, then ask your wife. She does it for you." "Well, no," I replied, "she doesn't." That stopped her. I might just as well have revealed that a UFO had deposited me for work that day, and my green antennas had been retracted so as not to frighten anyone. This caring, open-minded individual never had considered that there was someone who did not share the joy of Christmas. But it is true. Not only have I never Christmas shopped, but there has never been a Christmas tree in my house, and as a kid, I never sat on Santa's lap or listened for reindeer on the roof. To me, watching the glow, fuss, and joy of Christmas is like an anthropologist observing the rituals of some exotic tribe he lives among, but can never be fully part of. I can reach an exquisite intellectual understanding of the entire event, but from a distance. This puts me in one of America's most exclusive minorities, the 5% of us that does not celebrate Christmas. To me, Christmas has always been a holiday for others, a religious festival that has nothing to do with my background. I grew up Jewish, in a household only a decade removed from the Holocaust. Maintaining a distinct Jewish identity was important to my family, and Christmas, which I was taught and still believe is a religious holiday, was not part of it. We also did not celebrate Easter, Diwali, or Ramadan. Dad was self-employed, so the only thing December 25th meant was that he could not go out to work because there was no one out there to work with. Instead, we watched TV or later on, when movie theaters began to open on Christmas Day, went to a movie. There were Christmas trees in the classrooms of my public elementary school, and we sang Silent Night in music classes and assemblies. But I always choked on the words, "Christ the Savior is born," remaining silent or changing them to "Christ your Savior." Things have changed since my youth. Society has begun to understand that there are folks like me to whom all the fuss and frolic surrounding Christmas is vaguely threatening. Thus was born Happy Holidays, holiday trees, and winter break, as well as an undue public emphasis on Hanukkah, a minor Jewish holiday. It also spawned worries by a small portion of the 95% celebrating December 25th that there is a war on Christmas. Worrying about that is like being concerned that El Salvador might successfully invade Texas, never mind the entire U.S. Christmas is too much a part of the American culture to be threatened by pinpricks. As for putting menorahs next to creches in public displays, I find that insulting, frankly. It attempts to co-opt me into something I am not part of. Christmas is a legitimate strand in the strong weave of American culture and, as such, deserves the respect of us all, just as do the smaller strands of the Jewish holiday of Passover and the Muslims' Ramadan. If we want to acknowledge Jews in the public square, having shopping centers create April displays of matzah, the unleavened bread eaten during Passover, would be much more appropriate than including dreidel, dreidel, dreidel in holiday concerts. Meanwhile, I will continue to listen for jingle bells and deck the halls as I go about my business over the next several days, happy for all of you who find those songs to be joyful. I will even wish you a Merry Christmas. But I hope you will remember that some of us do not share in that merriment, and that we did not arrive on UFOs.
Lake Effect essayist Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than three decades. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in a variety of publications. One last break, and then an in-studio performance by musician Vince Sherman when Lake Effect continues on WUWN. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. 5 years ago, the band Army of Me was reaching fans around the world with a hit song, Going Through Changes, off a new album on a major label. It sounded like a bright future was ahead for the Washington, D.C. area band. But if you're familiar with them, you may wonder, whatever happened to Army of Me? Well, Army of Me is now back, this time as a solo project by its lead singer. Songwriter Vince Sherman was in Milwaukee for a house concert recently, and he stopped by the Lake Effect Studios to chat with Stephanie Lecce and fill in some of the gaps between then and now. But he started by playing his song, Modern Times.
I want to fly far away up where diamonds hang in the air. I want to take some light from the sun and bring it back to share. Place it high up on a hill, it'll light up the dark. I wanna learn love, wanna break my own heart. Oh, oh.
Vince Sherman, welcome to Lake Effect.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So your new album is called Searching for You, and mm-hmm. this is the first Army of Me album in, I believe, 6 years?
2007 was when it came out. So, yep, 6 years.
So tell us the story of the break there. What was going on?
Oh, the break. Oh, in between of 6 years. Well, I'd have to probably start before the record came out because we were a band. We're originally from Washington, D.C., and did the local band thing and then started building our following and started touring and worked really hard and got to a place where we were fortunate enough to have a record deal with a major label, and we were working with a big manager, major manager in the music industry, and the record was going to come out in April of 2007, and about 3 weeks before the record was supposed to come out, I was at the music festival South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And that festival, it's a lot of fun, and there's tons of bands playing, and you can get carried away with hanging out. And I was already like kind of feeling like a little bit of weirdness in my throat And got to the end of that time in Austin, and my voice was gone. But I was like, oh, you know, it'll come back. But it didn't. And by the time we got back to D.C., we had some shows on the way home. We had to cancel, like, the last couple of shows because my voice was totally gone. And I went to the doctor, and the doctor looked in my throat and said that I had a polyp on my vocal cords.
Now, for people who aren't singers, what does a polyp on your vocal cords mean?
I think it's basically like a blister. That's the best I can describe it.
But it
doesn't let you,
it doesn't let you sing.
Like, your voice is totally messed up. But, like, you for me at least, I have, like, my lower voice, but as soon as I go up, it would disappear. And so there's literally, like, there's nothing I could do. Physically, my voice was not there. I remember we even tried playing a couple of shows, and I just had to stop the show. So the doctor said I needed to take 6 weeks off singing.
And usually that would do it. Resting the voice would help the polyp, right?
Yeah, resting would help it heal. And, well, it didn't happen like that for me. And the frustrating thing was also, like, we had a record coming out in 3 weeks, but the doctor said I couldn't sing for six. And we had all this, like, promo and stuff set up, radio interviews and TV shows we were supposed to play on and all this stuff. And we had to cancel all that stuff. And just as my voice was actually starting to feel better, one night I sneezed and broke a blood vessel in my vocal cords. I had a vocal hemorrhage, which is just you never think that a sneeze would be that dangerous. A hemorrhage, it can be a career-ending thing. If you keep pushing or do anything while it's bruised like that, you can permanently mess up your voice. I went to the doctor and he said, you can't even make a sound. Don't clear your throat. Don't lift anything heavy. If you ever want to sing again, don't do anything, you know, just rest for a month. And I'm like, I don't want to rest. I want to go play shows and promote the record and do all this. So that was tough. I was carrying around a notepad and pen, and it was frustrating. It was disappointing. It was discouraging. It was really confusing. Like, really? I worked this hard to get to this point where my dream feels like it's about to come true. You got a major label putting your record out and all this stuff happening. And right then, the rug just got, like, pulled out.
So what happened to Army of Me?
Well, I kind of got my voice back, but not really. Like, I did some rehab. Just when you haven't used your voice in, like, 3 months, the muscles atrophy. So you had to kind of rebuild them back up again. And I was still having trouble with my voice the rest of the year. And finally in December, I had to have surgery on my vocal cords. So I had surgery, another period of rest, another period of, like, rehab. And my voice still wasn't better. And so we were touring and playing shows, but it wasn't there. I knew it. My doctor thought that I need to have another surgery, which I didn't even tell my band, because at this point they were like, really? You can't sing? And what ended up happening is about the summer of 2008, that's when people started to kind of really lose faith in what was happening in the project. And so had band members quit. A manager decided to go and let us go, or let me go, really. And label dropped us, and booking agent was like, yeah, sorry, everybody else is gone. I guess I'm gone too. And I was at the end of that process, I was really kind of left on my own of like, man, now what?
Did you think that music was going to be in your future at all at that point?
Well, it's a funny thing, this whole music thing. It's like something that you kind of can't imagine life without it, as much as you put into it. And every day you wake up, I wake up and I know what I'm supposed to do today because I know what I am. I'm a musician, you know. I know that I need to write songs, or I need to do this, or I need to do that. I definitely had moments of questioning and huge self-doubt of, like, can I do this? You know, what was that all about? Can I ever sing again? It took me years to actually get my voice back to full strength. So I did question, why am I doing this? Is this ever going to go anywhere? But I guess one thing that was at sort of some crucial moments of, like, dark times, I had some friends and supporters who would just say things like, your music means so much to me. You got to keep going. And at times when they didn't even know, I'm thinking in my head, what the hell am I doing? Why am I doing this? You know? So it was, I think, support of friends, of people who just encouraged me to keep going. And that's what I did, because it felt like I was supposed to keep going. It didn't feel to me inside like it was time to stop.
There's a song on the album that we'll play a little clip here called White Flag Flies.
But when the white flag flies, that's when the anguish dies. That's when the battle cries are fading away. And when there's peace at night, that's when your house gets quiet. That's when your heart can sigh and be filled again. When the white flag flies.
And it kind of is this idea of surrender to maybe circumstances outside of your control.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm guessing that this song was maybe inspired by some of what you were going through during this time.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I remember writing the lyrics to that song in the van. We were on our way. I think we were maybe on our way from Nashville to Atlanta with River James, actually. And the second verse, the lyric goes, the road curves up around the bend, another turn now, it's never the end. And I'm kind of like this metaphor of like you have this dream and you're following it and you're trying to pursue your passion, but you don't know where it's going. And a lot of times there's a lot of stuff out of your control. Actually, that line, we were literally turning a curve. And you know how it is. Whenever you're writing lyrics, you don't know where the next line's going to come from. And it's just, I guess we're turning now. Write that down. But yeah, the idea is, you can like really hold on to your own ideas and plans of what you think should happen or what you want to happen. And it's not always in your control. And I can really have like a lot of anxiety and a lot of tension and frustration, all that when all that happens. So the idea of white flag flies is that, in surrender, there's actually sort of like a calm peace, a serenity that comes with that. And I have found that that peace is more valuable to me than things going my way.
Why go back to the project Army of Me? Why not just start anew, reinvent yourself?
That's a good question. I went back and forth in my mind about if I'd call it something else or maybe use Army of Me again. It was another one of those things that I sat on for a long time. I was actually making the record and I didn't know what I was going to call it, Army of Me or something else. And it just sort of, I was actually in Rome in Italy hanging out with some people. And one night and we were at these people's house and they had a piano and they're like, hey, would you play a song? And so I played a couple songs and we started talking. One of the girls there was like, I saw your video and for this song Going Through Changes that was on our last record. And I was like, oh, you remember, you know what was going on during that time? This is back when I had like the vocal hemorrhage and I actually had mono at the time too.
You were
I was messed up. Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, I was telling them all about like the kind of the whole story. And I was like, yeah, I've been making this new record and I'm thinking about calling it Army of Me or something else. And it was so weird. It's like one of these crazy moments where everyone in the room, like one guy was like, I think Army of Me is cool because, you've been through this war, you've been through this battle and you're still marching, you're still going. And then another person was like, yeah, and Army of Me is like great solo name. And I was like, I guess maybe that's my answer right there. And as I thought more about it, I thought, like I used to think of Army of Me as, I can make my dreams come true if I work hard enough and I'm talented enough and I just make it happen. I'm this army and I can do it. And when I saw a lot of stuff that was out of my control, I didn't believe that anymore. And I actually doubted myself. I doubted my ability to do this stuff. And because there's so much out of your control and because I saw like my weakness and like physically couldn't even sing. But then I thought about like all the friends and supporters who kept me going. And then I thought, like, wow, Army of Me is like, it's me, but I've had this army of people around me who support me and who, like, encourage me. And, they're part of my army. And so that was kind of a new conception of what it actually meant. And I thought of myself as their army. And so now that's how I conceive Army of Me is, I'm not alone and neither are you. And this can be like a community feeling.
So can I riff on LL Cool J and say this is
go
a comeback?
Go for it.
Can we call it a comeback?
You can call it whatever you want. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, another song off the album that I think we'll close with now has just a really great story to how you wrote it. It's In My Blood.
Well, it was a few years ago, and I was starting to get into Bruce Springsteen. And I can't even remember the name of the record or the song that I was listening to, but he sang this line, and the way I heard it was, he said something about, your blood in my blood or something like that. Somebody's blood in somebody's blood. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy. That's like, to me, it was like radical intimacy of welcoming someone's blood into your blood. But I listened back to it and I was like, oh, that's really cool. And I listened back to it again. And it turned out he didn't actually say that. He said something else. And I was like, all right, well, I got that now. That's my line. I got to make a song from that. So, yeah, that song is basically a total ripoff of something I thought Bruce Springsteen said, but didn't. And I guess the idea of blood is like this, it's almost like kind of a scary thing. You know, if you see like a stranger on the street, you know, you're like, well, I don't know if I should touch them because who knows what kind of diseases they have. So the idea of I'm okay with your diseases touching me, like I'm okay with getting my hands dirty in like a relationship. I'm okay with like taking on what your struggles are and sharing mine with you. Like that's the kind of love that I feel like is really incredible. And that idea of that kind of intimacy was where that song came from.
Well, Vince Sherman, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about how Army of Me came back and a little bit about Searching for You. And we're going to hear one of those tracks coming out of our interview here, In My Blood. Vince, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Intimate as a whisper, you play the loudest bell. And I tasted salvation.
Vince Sherman performs under the name Army of Me. Its latest album is called Searching for You. We're hearing a track he played in the Lake Effect studio called In My Blood. We also heard White Flag Flies and Modern Times. You can hear all of them at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Vince Sherman talked with Stephanie Lecce while he was in Milwaukee for a recent house concert. That's Lake Effect for Wednesday. I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you listening, and I really do hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock, and have a great day.
And so deep you take me in and let your water cover me in a flood. Oh, I want your blood in my blood. Let your water cover me in a flood. How I want.